any money stuff you call dollars for 2 pennies. They lend it back to us at full face value, then charge you interest. You get the debt, they get the interest. They get the gold, you get the shaft.
They want it
a
all.
New world order. A new world order. A new world order. It is a big idea.
The CIA, the FBI, the ATF, and the FDA. They don't give a damn about the POW and the MIA. Hillary, Billary, Hitler, Marx, and Mao. They want a new world order. They want it all, and they want it now. This Illuminati imports the dope. They create the chaos, string us out, and crush our hope. They created AIDS. It's their designer disease to bring you down, to grovel on your knees. They want to vaccinate your child and give them the mark. They want to illuminate you and keep you in the dark. They want you to pay for it with plastic, surrender your soul. They want you under their thumb,
under their control. They want it all.
A new world order. A new world order.
Yes, folks, that's what they want, a new world order. But what is a new world order? Well, we're not going to get into that tonight, but we've covered it extensively in the past. We're going to cover it again sometime in the near future. The hour of the time is for your continuing education into those subjects that are not taught in our schools anymore, because they've been taken over by the Marxist Socialist National Education Association. Our colleges are in the grip of Marxist professors who hold tenure. It's a wonder that our children have any brains at all when they get through with the system that is in place at this time. You want to know what's going wrong with this country? Just go in your bathroom, close the door so that nobody can see the tears streaming down your face, and you'll find it staring at you from your own mirror. It's each and every one of us, ladies and gentlemen, that has allowed all of these things to happen. Tonight, we're going to find out what the framers intended. A linguistic analysis of the right to bear arms by Stephen P. Halbrook. In 1775, General Gage ordered that all private arms in Boston be deposited with the magistrates, supposedly to be stored temporarily and eventually returned to the owners. Those citizens, naive enough to comply with the general's edict, turned in 1,778 muskets, 634 pistols, 973 bayonets, and 38 blunderbusses. As the Declaration of Causes of Taking Up Arms passed by the Continental Congress stated, quote, "They accordingly delivered up their arms, but in open violation of honor. The governor ordered the arms deposited as aforesaid to be seized by a body of soldiers," end quote. One newspaper published a poem entitled Tom Gage's Proclamation, and it goes like this, folks. "That whosoever keeps gun or pistol, I'll spoil the motion of his sistel. But every one that will lay down his hanger bright and musket brown shall not be beat, nor bruised, nor banged, much less for past offenses hanged. But on surrendering his Toledo, go to and fro unhurt as we do. Meanwhile, let all and every one who loves his life forsake his gun." In a recent article, Professor Don Cates, one of these Marxist professors, acknowledged that the Second Amendment right of the people to keep and bear arms protects an individual right to keep arms in the home for self-defense. He contends, however, that the amendment serves to guarantee the right to carry them outside the home only in the course of militia service. And, of course, he believes that the militia is the National Guard. In that article and in this dialogue, Professor Cates argues that the following arms may be completely banned from private ownership: Saturday night specials, gangster weapons, whatever those are, brass knuckles, switchblade knives and short-barreled shotguns, purely offensive military weapons, and the urban possession of rifles, shotguns, and highly penetrative handgun bullets. Lastly, Professor Cates contends that permissive licensing and registration for gun ownership is constitutional. Well, folks, did the framers of the Second Amendment, as well as those of the 14th, intend constitutional protection of the right to bear arms to encompass the private carrying of arms for self-defense? And what arms are protected under that guarantee? May licenses and registration be required for exercise of a constitutional right per se? The following analysis seeks to resolve or at least clarify these questions. Did the framers intend the Second Amendment to encompass a right to carry guns for self-protection? Professor Lawrence Kress, who speaks for himself when he claims that we know little about the Second Amendment's reception in the states, has recently argued that the Founding Fathers would have been shocked by the idea that citizens could bear firearms for self-defense. Professor Cates bases his similar argument that there is no right to bear arms outside of militia service on an unpublished thesis of a law student. Yet Kress and Cates are well aware that the first state declaration of rights to use the term bear arms was that of Pennsylvania in 1776. Quote, "That the people have a right to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state," end quote. That to bear arms means simply to carry them was clear in a game bill drafted by Thomas Jefferson and proposed by James Madison, draftsman of the Second Amendment in the Virginia legislature. The bill would have fined those who hunted deer out of season, and if within a year the hunter shall bear a gun out of his enclosed ground, unless whilst performing military duty, he shall be in violation of his recognizance. The game violator would have to go back to court for, quote, "every such bearing of a gun," end quote, to be again bound to his good behavior. Thus, in the minds of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, to bear a gun meant to carry it about in one's hands or on one's person, as for instance, a deer hunter would do. Bearing arms is not associated with military duty only, for the language addresses the bearing of a gun by any person when not performing military duty. Further, while the bill would have restricted the carrying of scatter guns and other long guns for hunting, it would not have prohibited carrying pistols for self-defense. At that time, quote, one species of firearms, the pistol, was never called a gun, end quote. Previous game legislation had imposed a possible maximum penalty of 20 lashes on a violator's back. Madison's proposed legislation was intended to make the law more humane. Jefferson, on the other hand, strongly relied on the penal reform theories of Caesar Beccaria, whose essay on crimes and punishment was partly responsible for the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Quote, in America of the Revolutionary period, Beccaria's little book was more influential than any other single book. Its spirit incorporated in documents such as the Bill of Rights, end quote. Beccaria's influence on the Second Amendment only recently has come to light. Just months before writing the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson kept a commonplace book where he copied his favorite passages from legal writers. This book may well be considered as the source book and repertory of Jefferson's ideas on government. Among the passages Jefferson copied word for word was Beccaria's denunciation of laws which forbid deporter l'armée, which may be translated as to bear, carry, or wear arms. Now, that portion of Beccaria which Jefferson copied in Italian, writing false ideas of utility in the margin, was worded in the standard English translation of the time as follows. Now remember, Thomas Jefferson wrote in the margin false ideas of utility. And here it is, quote, a principal source of errors and injustice are false ideas of utility. For example, that legislator has false ideas of utility who considers particular more than general convenience, who had rather command the sentiments of mankind than excite them, and dares say to reason, be thou a slave, who would sacrifice 1,000 real advantages to the fear of an imaginary or trifling inconvenience, who would deprive men of the use of fire for fear of being burnt and of water for fear of being drowned, and who knows of no means of preventing evil but by destroying it. The laws of this nature are those which forbid to wear arms, disarming those only who are not disposed to commit the crime which the laws meant to prevent. Can it be supposed that those who have the courage to violate the most sacred laws of humanity and the most important of the code will respect the less considerable and arbitrary injunctions, the violation of which is so easy and of so little comparative importance? Does not the execution of this law deprive the subject of that personal liberty, comparative and so dear to mankind and to the wise legislator? And does it not subject the innocent to all the disagreeable circumstances that should only fall on the guilty? It certainly makes the situation of the assaulted worse and of the assailants better, and rather encourages than prevents murder, as it requires less courage to attack armed than unarmed persons. End quote. The wisdom of Beccaria was the source of Jefferson's proposed Virginia Constitution of 1776, which provided, quote, no freeman shall ever be debarred the use of arms, end quote. An avid hunter and gun collector, Jefferson carried pocket pistols, which may be seen today at Monticello, which was his home. John Adams began his opening statement in the Boston Massacre trial in 1770 with a quote from Beccaria. And in the course of his speech, he added that, quote, the inhabitants had a right to arm themselves at that time for their defense, end quote. Adams' own view against disarming the people were certainly consistent with the following favorite passage from Beccaria, which he copied in his diary. Quote, every act of authority of one man over another for which there is not an absolute necessity is tyrannical, end quote. Adams upheld the right of, quote, arms in the hands of citizens to be used at individual discretion in private self-defense, end quote. Bearing arms for personal protection was an unquestioned right in the minds of the founding fathers. Before the Revolution, James Iredell, who would be prominent in the struggle to ratify the Constitution and later a justice of the United States Supreme Court, wrote his mother, quote, be not afraid of the pistols you have sent me. They may be necessary implements of self-defense, though I dare say I shall never have occasion to use them. It is a satisfaction to have the means of security at hand, if we are in no danger, as I never expect to be. Confide in my prudence and self-regard for a proper use of them, and you need have no apprehension, end quote. In 1775, North Carolina's delegation to the Continental Congress, all of whom became prominent state or federal leaders, resolved, quote, it is the right of every English subject to be prepared with weapons for his defense, end quote. William Henry Drayton, a prominent revolutionary leader and chief justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court, quote, always had about his person a dirk and a pair of pocket pistols for the defense of his life, end quote. And a dirk, for those of you who may not know, is a knife. Very formidable knife, I might add, with a long, thin, very sharp blade, just right for sticking between a pair of ribs and just long enough to penetrate the heart. Up in Vermont, Ethan Allen and his friends, quote, never walked out without at least a case of pistols, end quote. Lodging with a Quaker on one occasion, Ethan's brother Ira recalled, quote, we took our pistols out of our holsters and carried them in with us. He looked at the pistols, saying, what doth thee do with these things? He was answered, nothing amongst our friends. But we were Green Mountain boys, and meant to protect our persons and property. End quote. Just 10 days after James Madison proposed the Bill of Rights to Congress in 1789, Tench Cox, a prominent Federalist and lifelong correspondent of Jefferson and Madison, wrote that what became the Second Amendment would confirm the people, quote, in their right to keep and bear their private arms, end quote. James Madison endorsed the widely published article in which these words appear. Cox's writings provide unmistakable evidence that 18th century Americans defined muskets, rifles, and pistols as, quote, arms, end quote, and that they endorsed an individual right to own and keep and use arms and consequently of self-defense and of the public militia power. His own firearms are the second and better right hand of every freeman, held Cox. In the 1830s, Madison wrote, quote, a government resting on a minority is an aristocracy, not a republic, and could not be safe with a numerical and physical force against it without a standing army, an enslaved press, and a disarmed populace, end quote. The founding fathers, you know, I just love to hear that stuff. I had to tell you that. The founding fathers in general strongly endorsed the right to bear arms for self-defense. They gave written expression to their views through the Second Amendment and personally exercised the right by owning and possessing arms. The same linguistic usage of the terms, quote, bear, end quote, and, quote, arms, end quote, prevailed during the period of the adoption of the 14th Amendment, which was intended to incorporate the Second Amendment. For instance, in 1865, Florida made it unlawful, quote, for any Negro, mulatto, or other person of color to own, use, or keep in his possession or under his control any bowie knife, dirk, sword, firearms, or ammunition of any kind unless he first obtain a license to do so from the judge of probate, end quote. And what do you think his chances were of getting that license? Violators faced a possible penalty of 39 stripes with a whip. The commission that drafted this legislation opined that, quote, the privilege of bearing arms should be accorded only to such of the colored population as can be recommended for their orderly and peaceable character, end quote. Members of the Reconstruction Congress, state constitutional conventions of the time, and mainstream white and even black newspapers cited protection of the right of freedom to bear arms to protect themselves and their families from infringement by sheriffs, militias, and the Ku Klux Klan as a major object of the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Acts, including what is now 42 United States Code, Section 1983. And while the Reconstruction Congress interpreted the Second Amendment, buttressed by the 14th, as protecting the rights of freedmen and even former Confederates to keep and bear private arms, it abolished the Southern state militia organizations, denying a Second Amendment protected right of states to organize militias. Although the real issue in the Morton Grove, Illinois handgun ban, America's first, involved the right to keep rather than to bear arms. The brief of Handgun Control Incorporated claimed, quote, the language of the Second Amendment suggests that its purpose is limited to protecting organized and effective state militias. The terms arms and bear arms have always been associated with organized military activity, end quote. The chief authority cited by Handgun Control Incorporated, for this proposition is Noah Webster's famous 1828 dictionary. Anyone who looks up Webster's definition of bear will be startled to find the very opposite of what Handgun Control Incorporated claimed. It says, quote, to bear as a mark of authority or distinction, as to bear a sword, a badge, a name, to bear arms in a coat, end quote. And that's why you can never take anyone's word for anything, ladies and gentlemen, because Handgun Control Incorporated just flat, simply lied. Although Handgun Control Incorporated also referred to Webster's definition of, quote, arms, end quote, this again fails to imply an exclusively military usage. Webster said, quote, weapons of offense are armor for defense and protection of the body, end quote. Consistent with the meaning of bear arms as carrying or wearing weapons on the person or inside one's clothing. Webster defines pistol as, quote, a small firearm or the smallest firearm used. Small pistols are carried in the pocket, end quote. As to who has the right to bear arms, Webster defined, quote, the people, end quote, as, quote, the commonality as distinct from men of rank, end quote. Webster, ladies and gentlemen, was certainly in a position to know what the Second Amendment phrases bear arms meant. A prominent Federalist, he wrote the first major pamphlet in support of the Constitution when it was proposed in 1787, in which he stated, quote, before a standing army can rule, the people must be disarmed, as they are in almost every kingdom in Europe. The supreme power in America cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword because the whole body of the people are armed. End quote. When the Morton Grove case was still before the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, unassailable evidence was presented that the respective framers of the Second and Fourteenth Amendments intended the individual right to keep arms, including pistols, to be protected from infringement by the federal, state, and local governments. The intent of the framers was so overwhelmingly contrary to the court's opinion upholding the gun ban that the court held that intent to be, quote, irrelevant, end quote, when throughout the history of the law, intent has been held by almost every court except for this one to be everything in the law. In contrast, the Supreme Court has stated repeatedly that the Constitution's provisions must be interpreted according to the intent of the framers. So, what arms are protected? As the Oregon Supreme Court recently opined, in the state constitutions adopted between 1776 and 1802, quote, the term arms, as used by the drafters of the constitutions, probably was intended to include those weapons used by settlers for both personal and military defense. The term arms was not limited to firearms, but included several hand-carried weapons commonly used for defense, end quote. Under the Second Amendment, all commonly possessed arms, which an individual could keep and bear, would be constitutionally protected both then and now. These arms include firearms, edged weapons, and blunt instruments. The most clearly protected firearm is the rifle, the use of which for self-defense, even in urban areas, is protected by the Second Amendment, quote, guarantee of the right of the individual to bear arms, end quote. The modern descendant of the musket, the rifle is the classic militia firearm. The shotgun is also protected by the Second Amendment. The short-barreled shotgun is the descendant of the blunderbuss, a classic home defense arm. In contrast with the long-barreled hunting shotgun, known traditionally as the fowling piece. While it may not be within judicial notice that the short-barreled shotgun is a militia arm protected by the Second Amendment, such an arm has been factually determined to fall within a state constitution protecting the right of citizens to, quote, keep and bear arms for their common defense, end quote. The arm most commonly possessed for self-defense is the pistol, due to its ease of storage, carriage, and, of course, accessibility. Quote, pistol, ex vi termini, is probably included within the word arms, and the right to bear such arms cannot be infringed, end quote. Its short barrel makes it difficult for an assailant to grab, and its size, weight, and simple mechanism makes its use viable for women, the elderly, and the handicapped. Smaller pistols have particular utility for smaller people. The smallest handgun designed by Smith & Wesson, quote, was such a small revolver that it was nicknamed the Lady Smith, since it seemed to be more suitable for a woman's small hand, end quote. And folks, being a large man with a large hand, I can tell you that that would be the conclusion that I would also reach, having held, examined, and inspected the Smith & Wesson Lady Smith revolver. It's a well-made, very good weapon, and I highly recommend it for those with hands small enough to be able to grip it properly. The relatively high cost of rifles as compared to pistols suggests that a ban on ownership or possession of low-caliber handguns would effectively negate any right of the poor to bear firearms for their self-defense. And that, of course, is the real intent of the